in a place far away from anyone they loved, had to die. I think it's because of Stuart that this bothers me so. But Charles Waring looks eerily thrilled by it all. I pick up a cigarette and put it back down. I'm trying not to smoke, but I'm nervous about tonight. Mother's been nagging me about my smoking, and I know I should stop, but it's not like it's going to kill me. I wish I could ask Pascagoula more about what Yule May said, but Pascagoula called this morning and said she had a problem and wouldn't be coming in until this afternoon. I can hear Mother out on the back porch, helping Jameso make ice cream. Even in the front of the house, I can hear the rumbly noise of ice cracking, the salt crunching. The sound is delicious. Makes me wish for some now, but it won't be ready for hours. Of course, no one makes ice cream at 12 noon on a hot day. It's a night chore. But Mother has it in her mind that she's going to make peach ice cream, and the heat be damned. I go out on the back porch and look. The big silver ice cream maker is cold and sweating. The porch floor vibrates. Jameso's sitting on an upside-down bucket, knees on either side of the machine, turning the wooden crank with gloved hands. Steam rises from the well of dry ice. "Has Pascagoula come in yet?" Mama asks, feeding more cream into the machine. "Not yet," I say. Mother is sweating. She pushes a loose strand of hair behind her ear. "I'll pour the cream a while, Mama. You look hot."
"You won't do it right. I have to do it," she says and shoos me back inside.
On the news, now Roger Sticker is reporting in front of the Jackson Post Office with the same stupid grin as the war reporter.
"This modern postal addressing system is called a ZZ zip code. That's right. I said ZZ zip code. That's 5 numbers to be written along the bottom of your envelope."
He's holding up a letter, showing us where to write the numbers. A man in overalls with no teeth says,
"Ain't nobody gonna use them there numbers. Folks is still trying to get used to using the telephone."
I hear the front door close. A minute passes and Pascagoula comes in the relaxing room. "Mother's out on the back porch," I tell her, but Pascagoula doesn't smile, doesn't even look up at me. She just hands me a small envelope.
"She was gonna mail it, but I told her I'd just carry it to you."
The front of the envelope is addressed to me. No return name on it. Certainly no zip code. Pascagoula walks off toward the back porch. I open the letter. The handwriting is in black pen, written on the straight blue lines of school paper.
"Dear Mosquito, I want you to know how sorry I am that I won't be able to help you with your stories. But now I can't, and I want to be the one to tell you why. As you know, I used to wait on a friend of yours. I didn't like working for her, and I wanted to quit many times. But I was afraid to. I was afraid I might never get another job once she had had her say. You probably don't know that after I finished high school, I went on to college. I would have graduated except I decided to get married. It's one of my few regrets in life, not getting my college degree. I have twin boys that make it all worthwhile, though. For 10 years, my husband and I have saved our money to send them to Tougaloo College. But as hard as we worked, we still didn't have enough for both. My boys are equally as smart, equally eager for an education. But we only had the money for one, and I ask you, how do you choose which of your twin sons should go to college and which should take a job spreading tar? How do you tell one that you love him just as much as the other, but you've decided he won't be the one to get a chance in life? You don't. You find a way to make it happen, any way at all. I suppose you could look at this as a confession letter. I stole from that woman. An ugly ruby ring, hoping it would cover the rest of the tuition. something she never wore, and I felt she owed me for everything I'd been through working for her. Of course, now, neither of my boys will be going to college. The court fine is nearly as much as we had saved. Sincerely, Yule Mae Crookle, Women's Block 9, Mississippi State Penitentiary. The penitentiary. I shudder. I look around for Pascagoula, but she's left the room. I want to ask her when this happened. How it happened so goddamn fast. What can be done? But Pascagoula's gone outside to help Mother. We can't talk out there. I feel sick. Nauseous. I switch off the television. I think about Yule Mae, sitting in a jail cell writing this letter. I bet I even know what ring Yule Mae's talking about. Hilly's mother gave it to her for her 18th birthday. Hilly had it appraised a few years ago and found out it wasn't even a ruby, just a garnet, hardly worth anything. Hilly never wore it again. My hands turned to fists. The sound of the ice cream churning outside sounds like bones crunching. I go to the kitchen to wait for Pascagoula, to get answers. I'll tell Daddy. I'll see if there's anything he can do. If he knows any lawyers who would be willing to help her. I walk up Abilene's steps at 8 o'clock that night. This was supposed to be our first interview with Yule Mae, and even though I know that's not going to happen, I've decided to come anyway. It's raining and blowing hard, and I hold my raincoat tight around me in the satchel. I kept thinking I'd call Abilene to talk about the situation, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. Instead, I practically dragged Pascagoula upstairs so Mother wouldn't see us talking, and asked her everything.
"You may had her a real good lawyer," Pascagoula said. "But everybody saying the judge wife be good friends with Miss Holbrook, and how a regular sentence be 6 months for petty stealing. But Miss Holbrook, she get it pushed up to 4 years. That trial was done before it even started."
I could ask Daddy. He could try and get her a white lawyer. Pascagoula shakes her head, says,
"He was a white lawyer."
I knock on Abilene's door. Feel a rush of shame. I shouldn't be thinking about my own problems when Yule Mae is in jail, but I know what this means for the book. If the maids were afraid to help us yesterday, I'm sure they're terrified today. The door opens and a Negro man stands there looking at me, his white clerical collar gleaming. I hear Abilene say, "It's okay, Reverend." He hesitates, but then moves back for me to come in. I step inside and see at least 20 people packed in the tiny living room and hallway. I cannot see the floor. Abilene's brought out the kitchen chairs, but most people stand. I spot Minnie in the corner, still in her uniform. I recognize Lou Ann Templeton's maid, Louvenia, next to her, but everyone else is a stranger.
"Hey, Miss Skeeter,"
whispers Abilene. She's still in her white uniform and white orthopedic shoes. "Should I..." I point behind me. I'll come back later," I whisper. Abilene shakes her head.
"Something awful happened to you, Mae."
"I know," I say. The room is quiet except for a few coughs. A chair creaks. Hymn books are stacked on the small wooden table.
"I just find out today,"
Abilene says.
"She arrested on Monday, in the pen on Tuesday. They say the whole trial took 15 minutes.
"She sent me a letter," I say. "She told me about her sons. Pascagoula gave it to me."
"She tell you she only short $75 for that tuition? She asked Miss Hilly for a loan, you know. Say she'd pay her back some every week. But Miss Hilly say no. That a true Christian don't give charity to those who's well and able. Say it's kinder to let them learn to work things out themselves.
God, I can just imagine Hilly giving that goddamn speech. I can hardly look Abilene in the face.
The church has got together, though. They gonna send both them boys to college.
The room is dead quiet, except for Abilene and my whispering. Do you think there's anything I can do? Any way I can help? Money or...
No. Church already set up a plan to pay the lawyer, to keep him on for when she come up for parole.
Abilene lets her head hang. I'm sure it's out of grief for Yule May, but I suspect she also knows the book is over.
They gon' be seniors by the time she get out. Court give her 4 years and a $500 fine.
I'm so sorry, Abilene, I say. I glance around at the people in the room, their heads bowed as if looking at me might burn them. I look down.
She evil, that woman!
Minnie barks from the other side of the sofa, and I flinch, hoping she doesn't mean me.
Hilly Holbrook been sent up here from the devil to ruin as many lives as she can.
Minnie wipes her nose across her sleeve.
Minnie, it's all right,
the Reverend says.
We'll find something we can do for her.
I look at the drawn faces, wondering what that thing could possibly be. The room goes unbearably quiet again. The air is hot and smells like burned coffee. I feel a profound singularity. Here, in a place where I've almost grown comfortable, I feel the heat of dislike and guilt. The bald Reverend wipes his eyes with a handkerchief.
Thank you, Abilene, for having us in your home for prayer.
People begin to stir, telling each other good night with solemn nods. Handbags are picked up, hats are put on heads. The Reverend opens the door, letting in the damp outside air. A woman with curly gray hair and a black coat follows close behind him, but then stops in front of me where I'm standing with my satchel. Her raincoat falls open a little to reveal a white uniform.
Miss Skeeter, she says without a smile, I'm gonna help you with the stories.
I turn and look at Abilene. Her eyebrows go up. Her mouth opens. I turn back to the woman, but she's already walking out the door.
I'm gonna help you, Miss Skeeter.
This is another woman, tall and lean, with the same quiet look as the first. Thank you, I say. I am too, Miss Skeeter. I'm gonna help you. A woman in a red coat walks by quickly, doesn't even meet my eyes. After the next one, I start counting. 5, 6, 7. I nod back at them, can say nothing but thank you. Thank you, yes, thank you, to each one. My relief is bitter, that it took Yule May's internment to bring us to this. 8, 9, 10, 11. No one is smiling when they tell me they want to help. The room clears out except for Minnie. She stands in the far corner, arms clamped across her chest. When everyone is gone, she looks up and meets my gaze for hardly a second, then jerks her eyes to the brown curtains pinned tight across the window. But I see it. The flicker on her mouth, a hint of softness beneath her anger. Minnie has made this happen. With everyone traveling, our group hasn't played bridge in a month. On Wednesday, we meet at Luann Templeton's house, greet with hand-patting and good-to-see-yous. Luann, you poor thing, in those long sleeves in this heat, is it the eczema again? Elizabeth asks because Luann's wearing a gray wool dress in the heat of summer. Luann looks at her lap, clearly embarrassed.
Yes, it's getting worse.
But I cannot stand to touch Hilly when she reaches out to me. When I back away from her hug, she acts like she doesn't notice. But during the game, she keeps looking at me with narrowed eyes.
What are you going to do?
Elizabeth asked Silly. You're welcome to bring the children over any time, but, well... Before Bridge Club, Hilly dropped Heather and William at Elizabeth's for Abilene to look after while we played bridge. But I already know the message in Elizabeth's sour smile. She worships Hilly, but Elizabeth does not care to share her help with anybody.
I knew it. I knew that girl was a thief the day she started.
As Hilly tells us the story of Yule May, she makes a big circle with her finger to indicate a huge stone, the unimaginable worth of the ruby.
I caught her taking the milk after it expired, and that's how it starts, you know. First it's washing powder, then they work their way up to towels and coats. Before you know it, they're taking the heirlooms, hawking them for liquor pints. God knows what else she took.
I fight the urge to snap each of her flapping fingers in half, but I hold my tongue. Let her think everything is fine. It's safer for everyone. After the game, I rush home to prepare for Abilene's that night, relieved there's not a soul in the house. I quickly flip through Pascagoula's messages for me. Patsy, my tennis partner. Celia Foote, whom I hardly know. Why would Johnny Foote's wife be calling me? Minnie's made me swear I'll never call her back, and I don't have time to wonder. I have to get ready for the interviews. I sit at Abilene's kitchen table at 6 o'clock that night. We've arranged for me to come over nearly every night until we're finished. Every 2 days, a different colored woman will knock on Abilene's back door and sit at the table with me, tell me her stories. 11 maids have agreed to talk to us, not counting Abilene and Minnie. That puts us at 13, and Mrs. Stein asked for a dozen, so I think we're lucky. Abilene stands in the back of the kitchen listening. The first maid's name is Alice. I don't ask for last names. I explain to Alice that the project is a collection of true stories about maids and their experiences waiting on white families. I hand her an envelope with $40 from what I've saved from the Miss Myrna column, my allowance, money Mother has forced into my hands for beauty parlor appointments I never went to. There's a good chance it may never be published, I tell each individually, and even if it is, there will be very little money from it. I look down the first time I say this, ashamed. I don't know why. Being white, I feel it's my duty to help them.
Abilene been clear on that, several say. That ain't why I'm doing this.
I repeat back to them what they've already decided among themselves, that they need to keep their identities secret from anyone outside the group. Their names will be changed on paper. So will the name of the town and the families they've worked for. I wish I could slip in, as the last question, by the way, did you know Constantine Bates? But I'm pretty sure Abilene would tell me it's a bad idea. They're scared enough as it is.
Now Eula, she gonna be like prying a dead clam open.
Abilene preps me before each interview. She's as afraid as I am that I'll scare them off before it even starts.
Don't get frustrated if she don't say much.
Eula, the dead clam, starts talking before she's even sat in the chair, before I can explain anything, not stopping until 10 o'clock that night.
When I asked for a raise, they gave it to me. When I needed a house, they bought me one. Dr. Tucker came over to my house himself and picked a bullet out my husband's arm because he was afraid Henry'd catch something at the colored hospital. I have worked for Dr. Tucker and Miss Sissy for 44 years. They've been so good to me. I wash her hair every Friday. I never seen that woman wash her own hair.
She stops for the first time all night, looks lonesome and worried.
If I die before her, I don't know what Miss Sissy gonna do about getting her hair washed.
I try not to smile too eagerly. I don't want to look suspicious. Alice, Fanny Amos, and Winnie are shy, need coaxing. Keep their eyes down to their laps. Flora, Lou, and Cleantine let the doors fly open and the words tumble out while I type as fast as I can, asking them every 5 minutes to please, please slow down. Many of the stories are sad, bitter. I expected this.
But there are a surprising number of good stories, too. And all of them, at some point, look back at Abilene as if to ask, "Are you sure? Can I really tell a white woman this?"
Abilene, what's gonna happen if this thing get printed and people find out who we are?
Shy Winnie asks.
What you think they do to us?
Our eyes form a triangle in the kitchen, one looking at the other. I take a deep breath, ready to assure her of how careful we're being.
My husband's cousin, they took her tongue out. A while back it was, for talking to some Washington people about the Klan. You think they're gonna take our tongues for talking to you?
I don't know what to say. Tongues? God, this hadn't exactly crossed my mind. Only jail and perhaps fake charges or fines. We're being extremely careful, I say, but it comes out thin and unconvincing. I look at Abilene, but she is looking worried too.
We won't know till the time comes, Winnie,
Abilene says softly.
Won't be like what you see on the news, though. A white lady do things different than a white man.
I look at Abilene. She's never shared with me the specifics of what she thinks would happen. I want to change the subject. It won't do us any good to discuss it.
Nah.
Winnie shakes her head.
I reckon not. Fact, a white lady might do worse.
Where are you going?
Mother calls from the relaxing room. I have my satchel and the truck keys. I keep heading for the door.
To the movies,
I call.
You went to the movies last night. Come here, Eugenia.
I backtrack. Stand in the doorway. Mother's ulcers have been acting up. At supper, she's been eating nothing but chicken broth, and I feel bad for her. Daddy went to bed an hour ago, but I can't stay here with her. I'm sorry, Mother, I'm late. Do you want me to bring you anything?
What movie and with whom? You've been out almost every night this week.
Just some girls. I'll be home by 10. Are you all right?
I'm fine. She sighs. Go on, then.
I head to the car, feeling guilty because I'm leaving Mother alone when she's not feeling well. Thank God Stuart's in Texas, because I doubt I could lie to him so easily. When he came over 3 nights ago, we sat out on the porch swing listening to the crickets. I was so tired from working late the night before, I could barely keep my eyes open, but I didn't want him to leave. I lay with my head in his lap. I reached up and rubbed my hand against the bristles on his face.
When are you going to let me read something you've written?
He asked. You can read the Miss Myrna column. I did a great piece on mildew last week. He smiled, shook his head.
No, I mean I want to read what you're thinking. I'm pretty sure it's not about housekeeping.
I wondered then if he knew I was hiding something from him. It scared me that he might find out about the stories, and thrilled me that he was even interested.
When you're ready, I won't push you, he said.
Maybe sometime I'll let you, I said, feeling my eyes close.
Go to sleep, baby,
he said, stroking my hair back from my face.
Let me just sit here with you for a while.
With Stuart out of town for the next 6 days, I can concentrate solely on the interviews. I head to Abilene's every night as nervous as the first time. The women are tall, short, black like asphalt or caramel brown. If your skin is too white, I'm told, you'll never get hired. The blacker, the better. The talk turns mundane at times, with complaints of low pay, hard hours, bratty children. But then there are stories of white babies dying in arms, that soft, empty look in their still blue eyes.
Olivia, she was called. Just a tiny baby, with her tiny hand holding on to my finger.
breathing so hard.
Fanny Amos says, our fourth interview.
Her mama wasn't even home, gone to the store for mentholatum. It was just me and the daddy. He wouldn't let me put her down, told me to hold her till the doctor get there. Baby grew cold in my arms.
There is undisguised hate for white women. There is inexplicable love. Faybelle, palsied and gray-skinned, cannot remember her own age. Her stories unfold like soft linen. She remembers hiding in a steamer trunk with a little white girl while Yankee soldiers stomped through the house. 20 years ago, she held that same white girl, by then an old woman, in her arms while she died. Each proclaimed their love as best friends, swore that death could not change this, that color meant nothing. The white woman's grandson still pays Faybelle's rent. When she's feeling strong, Faybelle sometimes goes over and cleans up his kitchen. Luvenia is my fifth interview. She is Luann Templeton's maid, and I recognize her from serving me at Bridge Club. Luvenia tells me how her grandson, Robert, was blinded earlier this year by a white man because he used a white bathroom. I recall reading about it in the paper as Luvenia nods, waits for me to catch up on my typewriter. There is no anger in her voice at all. I learn that Luann, whom I find dull and vapid and have never paid much mind to, gave Luvenia 2 weeks off with pay so she could help her grandson. She brought casseroles to Luvenia's house 7 times during those weeks. She rushed Luvenia to the colored hospital when the first call came about Robert and waited there 6 hours with her until the operation was over. Luann has never mentioned this to any of us, and I understand completely why she wouldn't. Angry stories come out of white men who've tried to touch them. Winnie said she was forced over and over. Cleantine said she fought until his face bled and he never tried again. But the dichotomy of love and disdain, living side by side, is what surprises me. Most are invited to attend the white children's weddings, but only if they're in their uniforms. These things I know already, yet hearing them from colored mouths, it is as if I'm hearing them for the first time. We cannot talk for several minutes after Gretchen's left.
Let's just move on,
Abilene says.
We don't got to count that one.
Gretchen is Yule May's first cousin. She attended the prayer meeting for Yule May that Abilene hosted weeks ago, but she belongs to a different church. I don't understand why she agreed if... I want to go home. The tendons in my neck have locked tight. My fingers are trembling from typing and from listening to Gretchen's words.
I'm sorry. I had no idea she gonna do that.
It's not your fault, I say. I want to ask her how much of what Gretchen said is true, but I can't. I can't look Abilene in the face. I had explained the rules to Gretchen, just like with the others. Gretchen had leaned back in her chair. I thought she was thinking about a story to tell. But she said,
Look at you. Another white lady trying to make a dollar off of colored people.
I glanced back at Abilene, not sure how to respond to this. Was I not clear on the money part? Abilene tilted her head like she wasn't sure she'd heard correctly.
You think anybody's ever gonna read this thing?
Gretchen laughed. She was trim in her uniform dress. She wore lipstick, the same color pink me and my friends wore. She was young. She spoke evenly and with care, like a white person. I don't know why, but that made it worse.
All the colored women you've interviewed, they've been real nice, haven't they?
Yes, I'd said. Very nice. Gretchen looked me straight in the eye.
They hate you. You know that, right? Every little thing about you. But you so dumb, you think you're doing them a favor. "You don't have to do this," I had said. "You volunteer. You know the nicest thing a white woman's ever done for me? Giving me the heel on her bread. The colored women coming in here, they're just playing a big trick on you. They'll never tell you the truth, lady." "You don't have any idea what the other women have told me," I said. I was surprised by how dense my anger felt and how easily it sprang up. "Say it, lady. Say the word you think every time one of us comes in the door. Nigger." Abilene stood up from her stool. "That's enough, Gretchen. You go on home. And you know what, Abilene? You are just as dumb as she is," Gretchen said. I was shocked when Abilene pointed to the door and hissed, "You get out of my house." Gretchen left, but through the screen door she slapped me with a look so angry it gave me chills. 2 nights later, I sit across from Callie. She has curly hair, mostly gray. She is 67 years old and still in her uniform. She is wide and heavy, and parts of her hang over the chair. I'm still nervous from the interview with Gretchen. I wait for Callie to stir her tea. There's a grocery sack in the corner of Abilene's kitchen. It's full of clothes, and a pair of white pants hangs over the top. Abilene's house is always so neat. I don't know why she never does anything with that sack. Callie begins talking slowly, and I start to type, grateful of her slow pace. She stares off as if she can see a movie screen behind me, playing the scenes she's describing.
"I worked for Miss Margaret 38 years. She had her a baby girl with a colic, and the only thing that stopped the hurting was to hold her. So I made me a wrap. I tied her up on my waist, toted her around all day with me for an entire year. That baby liked to break my back, put ice packs on it every night, and still do. But I love that girl, and I love Miss Margaret." She takes a sip of her tea while I type her last words. I look up and she continues. "Miss Margaret always made me put my hair up in a rag, say she know coloreds don't wash their hair. Counted every piece of silver after I'd done the polishing. When Miss Margaret died of the lady problems 30 years later, I go to the funeral. Her husband hug me, cry on my shoulder. When it's over, he give me an envelope. Inside a letter from Miss Margaret reading, 'Thank you for making my baby stop hurting.' I never forgot it." Callie takes off her black-rimmed glasses, wipes her eyes. "If any white lady reads my story, that's what I want them to know. Saying thank you, when you really mean it, when you remember what someone done for you." She shakes her head, stares down at the scratched table. "It's so good." Callie looks up at me, but I can't meet her eyes. "I just need a minute," I say. I press my hand on my forehead. I can't help but think about Constantine. I never thanked her. Not properly. It never occurred to me I wouldn't have the chance.
"You feel okay, Miss Skeeter?" Abilene asks.
"I'm fine," I say. "Let's keep going." Callie goes on to her next story. The yellow Dr. Scholl's shoebox is on the counter behind her, still full of envelopes. Except for Gretchen, all 10 women have asked that the money go toward Yule May's boy's education. Chapter 20. The Phelan family stands tense, waiting on the brick steps of State Senator Whitworth's house. The house is in the center of town, on North Street. It is tall and white-columned, appropriately azaleaed. A gold plaque declares it a historical landmark. Gas lanterns flicker despite the hot 6 o'clock sun.
"Mother," I whisper because I cannot repeat it enough times, "please
Please don't forget the thing we talked about.
I said I wouldn't mention it, darling.
She touches the pins holding up her hair.
Unless it's appropriate.
I have on the new light blue Lady Day skirt and matching jacket. Daddy has on his black funeral suit. His belt is cinched too tight to be comfortable, much less fashionable. Mother is wearing a simple white dress, like a country bride wearing a hand-me-down, I suddenly think. And I feel a rush of panic that we have overdressed, all of us. Mother's going to bring up the ugly girl's trust fund, and we look like country folk on a big damn visit to town. Daddy, loosen your belt. It's hitching your pants up. He frowns at me and looks down at his pants. Never once have I told my daddy what to do. The door opens.
Good evening.
A colored woman in a white uniform nods to us. They expecting y'all. We step into the foyer and the first thing I see is the chandelier, sparkling, gauzy with light. My eyes rise up the hollow twirl of the staircase, and it is as if we are inside a gigantic seashell.
Why, hello there.
I look down from my lollygagging. Mrs. Whitworth is clicking into the foyer, hands extended. She has on a suit like mine, thankfully, but in crimson. When she nods, her graying blonde hair does not move.
Hello, Mrs. Whitworth. I am Charlotte Boudreaux Cantrell Phelan. We thank you so much for having us.
Delighted,
she says and shakes both my parents' hands.
I'm Francine Whitworth. Welcome to our home.
She turns to me.
And you must be Eugenia. Well, it is so nice to finally meet you.
Mrs. Whitworth grasps my arms and looks me in the eyes. Hers are blue, beautiful, like cold water. Her face is plain around them. She is almost my height in her peau de soie heels.
So nice to meet you, I say.
Stewart's told me so much about you and Senator Whitworth. She smiles and slides her hand down my arm. I gasp as a prong of her ring scratches my skin.
There she is!
Behind Mrs. Whitworth, a tall, bull-chested man lumbers toward me. He hugs me hard to him, then just as quickly flings me back.
Now, I told little Stu a month ago to get this gal up to the house, but frankly,
he lowers his voice,
he's still a little gun-shy after that other one.
I stand there blinking. Very nice to meet you, sir. The senator laughs loudly.
You know I'm just teasing you,
he says, gives me another drastic hug, clapping me on the back. I smile, try to catch my breath, remind myself he is a man with all sons. He turns to Mother, solemnly bows and extends his hand.
Hello, Senator Whitworth,
Mother says.
I'm Charlotte.
Very nice to meet you, Charlotte. And you call me Stooley. All my friends do.
Senator,
Daddy says and pumps his hand hard.
We thank you for all you did on that farm bill. Made a heck of a difference.
Shee-you! That Billups tried to wipe his shoes on it. And I told him, I said, Chico, if Mississippi don't have cotton, hell, Mississippi don't have nothing.
He slaps Daddy on the shoulder, and I notice how small my father looks next to him.
Y'all come on in, the senator says. I can't talk politics without a drink in my hand.
The senator pounds his way out of the foyer. Daddy follows, and I cringe at the fine line of mud on the back of his shoe. One more swipe of the rag would have gotten it, but Daddy's not used to wearing good loafers on a Saturday. Mother follows him out, and I give one last glance up at the sparkling chandelier. As I turn, I catch the maid staring at me from the front door. I smile at her, and she nods. Then she nods again, and drops her eyes to the floor.
Oh!
My nervousness rises like a trill in my throat as I realize she knows. I stand, frozen by how duplicitous my life has become. She could show up at Abilene's, start telling me all about serving the senator and his wife.
"Stuart's still driving over from Shreveport," the senator hollers. "Got a big deal brewing over there, I hear."
I try not to think about the maid and take a deep breath. I smile like this is fine, just fine, like I've met so many boyfriends' parents before. We move into the formal living room with ornate molding and green velvet settees, so full of heavy furniture I can hardly see the floor.
"What can I get y'all to drink?"
Mr. Whitworth grins like he's offering children candy. He has a heavy, broad forehead and the shoulders of an aging linebacker. His eyebrows are thick and wiry. They wiggle when he talks. Daddy asks for a cup of coffee, Mother and I for iced tea. The senator's grin deflates and he looks back at the maid to collect these mundane drinks. In the corner, he pours himself and his wife something brown. The velvet sofa groans when he sits.
"Your home is just lovely. I hear it's the centerpiece of the tour," Mother says.
This is what Mother's been dying to say since she found out about this dinner. Mother's been on the dinky Ridgeland County Historic Home Council forever, but refers to Jackson's home tour as high cotton compared to theirs.
"Now, do y'all do any kind of dress-up or staging for the tours?"
Senator and Mrs. Whitworth glance at each other. Then Mrs. Whitworth smiles.
"We took it off the tour this year. It was just too much."
"Off? But it's one of the most important houses in Jackson. Why, I heard Sherman said the house was too pretty to burn."
Mrs. Whitworth just nods, sniffs. She's 10 years younger than my mother, but looks older, especially now as her face turns long and prudish.
"Surely you must feel some obligation for the sake of history," Mother says, and I shoot her a look to let it go.
No one says anything for a second, and then the senator laughs loudly.
"There was kind of a mix-up," he booms. "Patricia Vandevender's mother is head of the council, so after all that ruckamuck with the kids, we decided we'd just as soon get off the tour."
I glance at the door, praying Stuart will get here soon. This is the second time she has come up. Mrs. Whitworth gives the senator a deafening look.
"Well, what are we gonna do, Francine? Just never talk about her again? We had the damn gazebo built in the backyard for the wedding."
Mrs. Whitworth takes a deep breath, and I am reminded of what Stuart said to me, that the senator only knows part of it, but his mother, she knows all. And what she knows must be much worse than just ruckamuck.
"Eugenia," Mrs. Whitworth smiles, "I understand you aim to be a writer. What kinds of things do you like to write?"
I put my smile back on, from one good subject to the next. "I write the Miss Myrna column in the Jackson Journal. It comes out every Monday."
"Oh, I think Bessie reads that, doesn't she, Stooley? I'll have to ask her when I go in the kitchen."
"Well, if she doesn't, she sure as hell will now,"
the senator laughs.
"Stuart said you were trying to get into more serious subjects. Anything particular?"
Now everyone is looking at me, including the maid. A different one from the door, as she hands me a glass of tea. I don't look at her face, terrified of what I'll see there.
"I'm working on a few..."
"Eugenia is writing about the life of Jesus Christ,"
Mother pops in, and I recall my most recent lie to cover my nights out, calling it research.
"Well,"
Mrs. Whitworth nods, looks impressed by this,
"that's certainly an honorable subject."
I try to smile, disgusted by my own voice. "And such an important one." I glance at Mother. She's beaming. The front door slams, sending all the glass lamps into a furious tinkle.
"Sorry I'm so late,"
Stuart strides in, wrinkled from the car, pulling on his navy sports coat. We all stand up and his mother holds out her arms to him, but he heads straight for me. He puts his hands on my shoulders and kisses my cheek.
Sorry,
he whispers, and I breathe out, finally relax half an inch. I turn and see his mother smiling like I just snatched her best guest towel and wiped my dirty hands all over it.
Get yourself a drink, son. Sit down,
the senator says. When Stuart has his drink, he settles next to me on the sofa, squeezes my hand, and doesn't let go. Mrs. Whitworth gives one glance at our hand-holding and says,
Charlotte, why don't I give you and Eugenia a tour of the house?
For the next 15 minutes, I follow Mother and Mrs. Whitworth from one ostentatious room to the next. Mother gasps over a genuine Yankee bullet hole in the front parlor, the bullet still lodged in the wood. There are letters from Confederate soldiers lying on a federal desk, strategically placed antique spectacles and handkerchiefs. The house is a shrine to the war between the states, and I wonder what it must have been like for Stuart, growing up in a home where you can't touch anything. On the third floor, Mother gaggles over a canopy bed where Robert E. Lee slept. When we finally come down a secret staircase, I linger over family pictures in the hallway. I see Stuart and his two brothers as babies, Stuart holding a red ball, Stuart in a christening gown, held by a colored woman in white uniform. Mother and Mrs. Whitworth move down the hall, but I keep looking, for there is something so deeply dear in Stuart's face as a young boy. His cheeks were fat, and his mother's blue eyes shone the same as they do now. His hair was the whitish yellow of a dandelion. At 9 or 10, he stands with a hunting rifle and a duck. At 15, next to a slain deer. Already he is good-looking, rugged. I pray to God he never sees my teenage pictures. I walk a few steps and see high school graduation. Stuart, proud in a military school uniform. In the center of the wall, there's an empty space without a frame. A rectangle of wallpaper just the slightest shade darker. A picture has been removed.
Dad, that is enough about...
I hear Stuart say, his voice strained. But just as quickly there is silence.
Dinner is served,
I hear a maid announce, and I weave my way back into the living room. We all trail into the dining room to a long, dark table. The Phelans are seated on one side, the Whitworths on the other. I am diagonal from Stuart, placed as far as possible from him. Around the room, the wainscoting panels have been painted to depict scenes of pre-Civil War times, happy Negroes picking cotton, horses pulling wagons, white-bearded statesmen on the steps of our capital. We wait while the senator lingers in the living room.
I'll be right there. Y'all go ahead and start.
I hear the clink of ice, the clop of the bottle being set down 2 more times before he finally comes in and sits at the head of the table. Waldorf salads are served. Stuart looks over at me and smiles every few minutes. Senator Whitworth leans over to Daddy and says,
I came from nothing, you know. Jefferson County, Mississippi. My daddy dried peanuts for 11 cents a pound.
Daddy shakes his head.
Doesn't get much poorer than Jefferson County.
I watch as Mother cuts off the tiniest bite of apple. She hesitates, chews it for the longest time, winces as it goes down. She wouldn't allow me to tell Stuart's parents about her stomach problem.
Instead, Mother ravishes Mrs. Whitworth with degustationary compliments.
Mother views this supper as an important move. In the game called Can My Daughter Catch Your Son?
The young people so enjoy each other's company, Mother smiles. Why, Stuart comes out to see us at the house nearly twice a week.
Is that right? Says Mrs. Whitworth.
We'd be delighted if you and the senator could drive out to the plantation for supper sometime. Take a walk around the orchard?
I look at Mother. Plantation is an outdated term she likes to use to gloss up the farm, while the orchard is a barren apple tree, a pear tree with a worm problem. But Mrs. Whitworth has stiffened around the mouth.
Twice a week? Stuart, I had no idea you came to town that often.
Stuart's fork stops in midair. He casts a sheepish look at his mother.
Y'all are so young, Mrs. Whitworth smiles. Enjoy yourselves. There's no need to get serious so quickly.
The senator leans his elbows on the table.
From a woman who practically proposed to the other one herself, she was in such a hurry.
Dad,
Stuart says, through gritted teeth, banging his fork against his plate. The table is silent, except for Mother's thorough, methodical chewing to try to turn solid food into paste. I touch the scratch, still pink along my arm. The maid lays pressed chicken on our plates, tops it with a perky dollop of mayonnaise-y dressing, and we all smile, glad for the mood breaker. As we eat, Daddy and the senator talk about cotton prices, boll weevils. I can still see the anger on Stuart's face from when the senator mentioned Patricia. I glance at him every few seconds, but the anger doesn't seem to be fading. I wonder if that's what they'd argued about earlier, when I was in the hall. The senator leans back in his chair.
Did you see that piece they did in Life magazine? One before Medgar Evers about, what's his name, Carl Roberts?
I look up, surprised to find the senator is aiming this question at me. I blink, confused, hoping it's because of my job at the newspaper. He was lynched for saying the governor was... I stop, not because I've forgotten the words, but because I remember them.
Pathetic, the senator says, now turning to my father. With the morals of a streetwalker.
I exhale, relieved the attention is off me. I look at Stuart to gauge his reaction to this. I've never asked him his position on civil rights, but I don't think he's even listening to the conversation. The anger around his mouth has turned flat and cold. My father clears his throat.
I'll be honest, he says slowly. It makes me sick to hear about that kind of brutality.
Daddy sets his fork down silently. He looks Senator Whitworth in the eye.
I've got 25 Negroes working my fields, and if anyone so much as laid a hand on them, or any of their families...
Daddy's gaze is steady. Then he drops his eyes.
I'm ashamed. I'm ashamed sometimes, Senator. Ashamed of what goes on in Mississippi.
Mother's eyes are big, set on Daddy. I'm shocked to hear this opinion. Even more shocked that he'd voice it at this table to a politician. At home, newspapers are folded so the picture's face down. Television channels are turned when the subject of race comes up. I'm suddenly so proud of my daddy, for many reasons. For a second, I swear I see it in Mother's eyes, too, beneath her worry that Father has obliterated my future. I look at Stuart and his face registers concern, but in which way I do not know. The senator has his eyes narrowed on Daddy.
I'll tell you something, Carlton,
the senator says. He jiggles the ice around in his glass.
Bessie, bring me another drink, would you please?
He hands his glass to the maid. She quickly returns with a full one.
Those were not wise words to say about our governor,
the senator says.
I agree 100%,
Daddy says.
But the question I've been asking myself lately is, are they true?
Stooley,
Mrs. Whitworth hisses. But then just as quickly she smiles, straightens.
Now, Stooley,
she says like she's talking to a child.
Our guests here don't want to get into all your politicking during...
Francine, let me speak my mind. God knows I can't do it from 9 to 5, so let me speak my mind in my own home.
Mrs. Whitworth's smile does not waver, but the slightest bit of pink rises in her cheeks. She studies the white Floradora roses in the center of the table. Stuart stares at his plate with the same cold anger as before. He hasn't looked at me since the chicken course. Everyone is quiet, and then someone changes the subject to the weather. When supper is finally over, we're asked to retire out on the back porch for after-dinner drinks and coffee. Stuart and I linger in the hallway. I touch his arm, but he pulls away.
I knew he'd get drunk and start in on everything.
Stuart, it's fine, I say, because I think he's talking about his father's politics. We're all having a good time. But Stuart is sweating and feverish looking.
It's Patricia this and Patricia that all night long, he says. How many times can you bring her up?
Just forget about it, Stuart. Everything's okay. He runs a hand through his hair and looks everywhere but at me. I start to get the feeling that I'm not even here to him. And then I realize what I've known all night. He is looking at me, but he's thinking about her. She is everywhere. In the anger in Stuart's eyes, on Senator and Mrs. Whitworth's tongues, on the wall where her picture must have hung. I tell him I need to go to the bathroom. He steers me down the hall. Meet us out back, he says, but does not smile. In the bathroom, I stare at my reflection, tell myself that it's just tonight. Everything will be fine once we're out of this house. After the bathroom, I walk by the living room, where the senator is pouring himself another drink. He chuckles at himself, dabs at his shirt, then looks around to see if anyone's seen him spill. I try to tiptoe past the doorway before he spots me.
There you are,
I hear him holler as I slip by. I back up slowly into the doorway and his face lights up.
What's the matter, you lost?
He walks out into the hallway.
No, sir, I was just going to meet everybody.
Come here, gal.
He puts his arm around me and the smell of bourbon burns my eyes. I see the front of his shirt is saturated with it.
You having a good time?
Yes, sir, thank you.
Now, Stuart's mama, don't you let her scare you off. She's just protective is all.
Oh, no, she's been very nice. Everything's fine. I glance down the hall where I can hear their voices. He sighs, stares off.
We've had a real hard year with Stuart. I guess he told you what happened.
I nod, feeling my skin prickle.
Oh, it was bad, he says. So bad.
Then suddenly he smiles.
Look here. Look who's coming to say hello to you.
He scoops up a tiny white dog, drapes it across his arm like a tennis towel.
Say hello, Dixie, he croons. Say hello to Miss Eugenia.
The dog struggles, strains its head away from the reeking smell of the shirt. The senator looks back at me with a blank stare. I think he's forgotten what I'm doing here. I was just headed to the back porch, I say.
Come on. Come in here.
He tugs me by the elbow, steers me through a paneled door. I enter a small room with a heavy desk, a yellow light shining sickishly on the dark green walls. He pushes the door shut behind me, and I immediately feel the air change, grow close and claustrophobic.
Now look. Everybody says I talk too much when I've had a few, but...
The senator narrows his eyes at me, like we are old conspirators.
I want to tell you something.
The dog's given up all struggle, sedated by the smell of the shirt. I'm suddenly desperate to go talk to Stuart. Like every second I'm away, I'm losing him. I back away.